international bond finance. We can understand the structure and operation of the bond markets using these core tables provided. We're looking at the Eurobond market, which is a core part of the international financial system, international capital market area arena. We're focusing on Eurobonds specifically. That is any debt instrument or set of debt instruments entered into in a currency outside the country of issuance. I've provided a short historical reference at the back on the top left. When did this begin? It began with early public debt instruments, going back to the Monte Comune in Florence in the 1300s. We had early annuities, including perpetual annuities, were created, for example, by the Habsburgs in the Netherlands in 1450 and 1600s. One of the first companies in the world was the East India Company. It was issuing bonds as early as 1609. Technically, the first company that was ever established was the Aberdeen Harbour Company in 1136. That was by King David I in Scotland. And I'll give you a separate series of notes on the history of companies, company law, when we look at capital markets in further detail. In terms of the UK markets development, a lot of the key international finance was raised in London, end of the 1600s, beginning of the 1700s, as part of what we call the financial revolution, beginning in 1688. That's what really establishes Great Britain as the centre of the financial, trading and commercial world, and is the beginning of what will become the British Empire and then the British Commonwealth. It all began with the financial revolution, 1688. It wasn't with the Industrial Revolution, because the Industrial Revolution isn't until 50 years later, 1740, 1750, 60, 1780, and then the second Industrial Revolution at the end of the 1700s, beginning of the 1800s. All of this actually began with the Financial Revolution, which is when Parliament takes control. It subjects kings and queens in the monarchy to strict rules on their ability to tax the people, and then spend that for war purposes. Basically, we had Prince William is invited from Holland with his queen, Queen Mary, to come over and become the king and queen in England, but the condition under the Bill of Rights is that they respect parliamentary sovereignty. This is the beginning of modern parliamentary democracy, parliamentary control. This is the creation of the modern welfare state. At the same time, we also have the London coffee houses, coffee shops, which then become into some of the main markets in the world. We have the beginning of a public debt market, with the beginning of organised taxation and other formal governance systems. This is the beginning of the modern world. And all began with the financial revolution in Great Britain, beginning in 1688. The early bond markets then developed very quickly. We had, for example, the 3% annuities from 1726 and then the consols from 1751 onwards. That then takes us all the way up to the post-World War period. Bond markets, whether the state government bond markets or corporate bond markets, are generally domestic, so we're issuing bonds in the local currency. The significance of the Eurobond market after the Second World War is that we're issuing the bonds in currency other than the country of issuance. Essentially, what happens is London re-emerges as the most important international financial centre after the Second World War, despite the loss of prestige and the reputation and status of sterling, and the fact that our gold reserves and foreign currency reserves were completely exhausted by two world wars. London still re-emerges as the principal primary international financial centre. Essentially and initially, because all of the massive volume of new dollars which were created in America, because they can't lend them and use them in America efficiently and effectively, and because of higher levels of regulation which couldn't allow them to be used in the international markets, all of those dollars are moved to London and then lent out from London around the world. This is the beginning of the euro dollar system. The first euro bond was the Otto Strada issue. That was on 1st July 1963. And I've just noted that further below, S.G. Warburg, £50 million, $50 million, 5.5% guaranteed, 1972-78. So that's the background to the bond markets. Advantages, principal advantages we can understand in terms of transferability and negotiability. It's not like the loan markets, when historically loans were inherently non-transferable. You couldn't transfer a person with debt. That's why we used to, for example, have debtors' prisons. You couldn't pay your debt, you went to jail. We can now transfer loans through legal assignment or equitable assignment, as well as novation, that aren't devices, but that's still much more inflexible, less fluid, less flexible than the capital markets. In the capital markets, we have bonds which are securities, and they are not just transferable, they are negotiable. That means that the acquirer obtains perfect title, perfect legal title, so long as they acquire the bond without any notice of prior defect in title. So negotiability as well as transferability. We also have anonymity. These markets initially in the 1960s and 1970s, it was all based on bearer instruments rather than registered bonds, registered securities. The fact that we used bearer instruments meant that these would be transferred by delivery. This also made them very attractive for individual investors because it gave them a certain control and confidentiality and anonymity from the tax collector. So a large number of individuals were buying these, holding them with custodians, but because they were bearer, they didn't have to be disclosed and their ownership entitlement didn't have to be revealed. We used to talk about the Belgian dentist. Apparently Belgian dentists in the 1960s and 1970s were very wealthy and used to buy a lot of these early Eurobonds. We've also got flexibility of management because we can buy and sell them. There's a lot of choice in this market, and also just the liquidity in the market means there's always a buyer and seller in this market. The main bonds and gilts that we're dealing in, especially with the major economies and the major government and corporate debt instruments, there are always markets, 24 hours a day, every day of the year, including a lot of this being managed simply through robots, bots and algorithms now. You can always buy and sell this. It's as good as cash. So you have massive liquidity in these markets, as well as disposability. If you need funds, you simply sell it. With a loan, you can't call in a loan quickly, you can't sell it quickly, because the acquirers have to undertake a separate credit assessment. That can take time, and very often, if you're trying to sell a loan, someone may want a discount or even a deep discount, so you may lose a lot of the value, especially if you're trying to sell it quickly. You have none of these difficulties in the bond market. So, transferability, anonymity, flexibility, liquidity, and disposability. Also, disadvantages. There are some problems. It's costly. It's more complex transactions. There's more parties, therefore there's more documentation. So there's a bit more law involved. There's a bit more banking involved, but it's still completely manageable. You have a lot of choice, but there's still a constraint in the sense that bonds of themselves, because they're securities, once they're issued, they lack the flexibility that you have in a loan relationship. In a loan document, in a loan situation, you enter into an agreement, usually, for example, based on the Loan Market Association standard multi-currency revolving term loan agreement, 100 pages. That gives you enormous flexibility over the duration of the loan, which might be 20 years. In the bond market, the note market, and the paper market, you have to pre-design all of the choices and options into the instrument up front, because once it's issued, it's very difficult to change it. So a lot of this is done on a pre-design basis. What we're going to see is there's a large number of variations in the markets for all of the different types of bonds. Everything from a plain vanilla, simple euro bond market, euro bond transaction, structure, issue, all the way up to all the more complex euro bonds, note programs, and then paper issues. So there is choice, but the choice is locked into the instrument, so you buy what you need, and if you don't need it and you want something else, you sell it. You've also got regulation and taxation. Because these are sold to the public, there's a lot more heavy regulation in this area. In the loan market, it's professional counterparties, governments, the largest companies in the world, and the largest banks in the world dealing with each other on a face-to-face principal basis. There's very little conflicts of interest, so there's very little law and regulation in this market. The market's essentially unregulated. When we come to the bond markets, we're selling these bonds into public markets. Therefore, we're dealing with the general public. Therefore, it brings forward the whole panoply of securities regulation. There are ways of avoiding this in practice, and there's deals and transactions we can look at, although there's a lot more regulation you have to be very careful of. In particular, for example, dealing with American counterparties, if you sell a security to any American anywhere in the planet, in the world, on the planet, you can breach American securities laws. So if you do not want to do that, and if you do not design the issue in such a way that it's compliant with American securities law, you will attach large numbers of legends, basically banners, stickers, all over the documentation to say this cannot be sold to an American citizen anywhere in the world, because otherwise you're going to trigger the extraterritorial application of the American securities law and the American Securities and Exchange Act, as well as other securities laws, and I'll give you further documentation on this later. And then market volatility. The benefit is negotiability, liquidity, but you've also got volatility, price variability. The bond won't keep its value, the value will go up or down. That then takes us into the discussion of bond pricing and bond yield. The bond price and the yield are basically the inverse of each other. There's different types of yields. You will have interest on a fixed bond. Legally, a bond is a fixed rate instrument. If it's a note, legally it's a floating instrument, and paper will be floating as well. Strictly speaking, notes can be fixed or floating, but in law, if it's a bond, it's fixed. So you can't have short bonds if it's fixed. A fixed 1 year note is technically, legally, a bond. And a 20-year floating rate instrument is technically a note. So we just need to watch that. In terms of market practice, we tend to talk about bonds roughly 15, 20 years plus. Notes, anything between 1 and 20 years, and then paper up to 1 year. Although legally, technically, if it's fixed, it's a bond, and if it's floating, it's a note. There's different types of yields that we can look at. Basically, if the bond price goes down, the yield goes up, which essentially means that the governments are having to pay more because they borrow the same amount of funds. There's different types of yield. All I've done is refer to some of these on the system for you. So we have the coupon yield, which is annual coupon divided by the face value. The current yield is the coupon divided by the bond price. We have yield to maturity, the YTM, that's future cash flows. So the price divided equals the discounted cash flow divided by the yield to maturity. The half YTM is called the BEV, the B, the bond equivalent yield. And we also have effective annual yield. You do not need to know these things as lawyers. You will never be involved with negotiating these or setting them. It just helps if you understand the background to the market, how these operate. There's very good discussion and explanation of this, for example, on Investopedia or on other links on the website. What then is our bond issue? What have we got? All of the parties I list on the front page, and I've designed a sort of typical issue. What we have is this. We've got an issuer. We have the investors on the right, which might be public investors or private investors, such as the historical Belgian dentist. We will have an arranging bank who's going to put the deal together. We may have a trustee, depending upon the size. We will always have an agent. If there's a trustee and a trustee, we will have a paying agent. If there's no trustee, because the agent needs to hold the funds on trust on behalf of the bond holders, there'll be a fiscal agency agreement. We then, if it's a large issue, we'll have a selling group that's going to sell, and we'll also have a separate underwriting group if it's a very large issue. What simply happens is this. The selling group are going to sell the bonds into the market, either to their own clients, customers, or more generally. If they do not sell everything, the underwriters come in and buy anything that's not been sold. So the underwriters, their role and function is to confirm that all of the bond amount is raised on the closing. The issuer just needs to ensure that if it's issuing, for example, 100 million 5-year bonds, that it receives that 100 million. It doesn't actually care how it's sold, where it goes, who's buying it, how it's managed, so long as it's sold. So in a large issue, what we'll do is we'll have an underwriter who's going to confirm that all the residual stock will be taken up. However, in smaller deals, the arranging bank itself may commit to purchase everything. And we call that a bought deal or a private placement. The arranging bank will then simply undertake to buy all of the bonds and then sell them on through his own books. And I'll show you how that works in practice in a couple of minutes. We may have a separate custodian as well, and then there are some other parties may be involved. We'll look at that. There's different sort of agent banks. You'll see on the back page here, I refer, I think, to what we call calculation agents. Well, there's the parties there. Calculation agents, transfer agents, and exchange agents, who just carry specific functions, again, depending upon the size and length of the bond. The parties themselves will have the issuer, we have the investors, we have the arranger, we have the selling group, we have the trustee. We have the payment agent, if there's no trustee, if there's a trustee, and then if there's no trustee, we have a fiscal agent. There may be other agents, such as the calculation, transfer, and exchange agent, as we've already mentioned. And then we also have the custodians, either Euroclear or Clearstream. And I've summarised them just above again. Euroclear was initially set up by JP Morgan in 1968. Clearstream was originally established as Sidel in 1970, and then later renamed Clearstream. Euroclear is based in Brussels. Clearstream is based in Luxembourg. The market is managed and run out of London. 50-60% of this market still is in London. They wanted to create a form of custodianship to hold the bonds outside London, so they picked Brussels and Luxembourg. These are still the largest markets in this area. On the slides that I've given you, I've got photographs of Euroclear and Clearstream, and you can see a lot of this on the system as well. What tends to happen is the bonds will be issued, but in this market, because they're such high value and because they are bearer instruments, transferable by delivery, you need to keep them secure. In practice, what usually happens is the bonds are issued and immediately put into a custodian. We call that immobilization. You'll see on the middle right there, immobilization. They're immobilized. They never actually leave the custodian. If you buy and sell, you buy and sell across the accounts of Euroclear and Clearstream. And all the largest banks and commercial banks in the world will have an account. Or they'll have a counterparty who is an account member. There's also a bridge between Luxembourg and Brussels. You may not know this. Between Euroclear and Clearstream, there's an optical cable. There's an optical bridge. So you can buy and sell across the accounts between Euroclear and Clearstream as well. So all of these bonds, this whole of this massive market, over $100 trillion, can all be managed through the accounts held on these two custodians. In the early markets, the 60s, 70s, up to the beginning of the 80s, if we had a paper certificate, if we had an actual bond produced, it would be immobilized. And what would happen is the agents or the custodians would present the coupons to the agents to collect the funds to then pay into the account. More modern issues are now dematerialized. That means everything's electrified. It's issued in an electronic format. There's no paper, so we dematerialize. We've also got this idea of, just so that we're not confused, disintermediation. Disintermediation arises when you've got the shorter notes, euro notes and commercial paper. What we don't want to do is this. We set it up in the form of a program. We don't want to have to go back to the arranging bank every time the company wants to issue some more short notes or commercial paper into the market. So we set a program up. We call that disintermediation. You remove the investment bank. You remove the bank out of the situation. You set a program up that might last, for example, 20 years. But during that 20 years, the company can then issue 5-year notes, 3-year notes, 1-year notes, or commercial paper. Anything from 5 days up to 360 days. When you've got these shorter instruments, we disintermediate. You don't want to keep going back to bring the arranging bank back in again. You allow the issuer to issue the paper or the notes directly into the market. We set a program up to do that. What we will then see is this. we can either have that committed or uncommitted, in the sense that the arranging bank is obliged to buy or not buy. And on the back page there, you'll see I've got euro note and commercial paper. This becomes a little confused in practice. What's the difference between shorter euro notes and 1 year commercial paper? Euro notes are still underwritten, so that if the issuer issues the euro notes, the banks still have to purchase them. They're committed to do so. With commercial paper, there's no obligation to purchase. You can issue euro notes within days, you can issue commercial paper within hours. Maturities tend to be fixed, but they're longer for the euro notes, can be very short for commercial paper. Settlement can take 7 days to settle, set up the program and begin to issue. You can do on the same day with a commercial paper program. Denominations, euro notes, typically $500,000, commercial paper, $100,000. So what we can see is this: commercial paper is a very flexible, fluid form of instrument for large companies to raise funds. And what tends to happen in particular in the largest markets, including specifically America, because the commercial paper market is so advanced and so well developed, most companies will not even use an overdraft, because overdrafts are expensive. The largest companies, commercial companies in America, including all the big tech companies, Apple, Amazon, Google, they simply have commercial paper programs in place, so to pay their wages each month, or to pay their electricity bills, or to pay their coffee bills, or their donut bills, they simply issue commercial paper. It's the easiest, simplest way. And who's buying this? The money market funds. In America, you have a separate parallel money market fund market, which is a specialist market that basically only purchases treasury bills and corporate bonds or short commercial paper. Typically, an individual will not buy a treasury bill because they're usually only issued in minimum denominations of $100,000. So most people do not buy a single treasury bill. But what they do is they put funds into a specialist investment company called a money market fund. It pulls those funds and it invests in the treasury bill market, or the corporate bond market, or the commercial paper market. One of the difficulties that actually arose with the global financial crisis, and actually one of the key triggers of the crisis, was the fact that we did not have a bank run, but after the closure of Lehman Brothers, the fourth largest investment firm, securities firm in Wall Street, on the evening of 14th September 2008 and morning of Monday 15th September 2008, that did not create a bank run, which is typically what happens when you have a crisis. People ask for their money back from the banks. The depositors go to the banks, please give me my money back. We actually had that in the UK. We had a commercial bank run on Northern Rock. In America, it wasn't a commercial bank run, it was a money market fund run. All the money, people holding funds with money markets wanted their money back. The money market funds couldn't then purchase the commercial paper that was issued by the largest companies in America, so the largest companies in America couldn't fund their short working capital balance sheets. And what happened was, by the following Friday, the American authorities had to provide an open guarantee to a $3.5 trillion money market fund market in America. So this is the basic terms and conditions, structure and operation of the core market. So we've got key parties where we're looking at the agents. You may also have guarantors. You've got Euroclear and Clearstream, which has been talking about. You may have other sub-custodians, although less common, because if we get everything can be located and held with Euroclear and Clearstream, why would you need to move them? You will have custodians in almost every financial centre, because companies and governments are always buying and lending, so therefore they always need agents to hold the funds. So you always have custodians in almost all financial centres. And then clearly you'll also need lawyers, accountants and auditors, and tax experts. Accountants are the internal accounting advisors for the companies. The auditors are the external professionals who confirm that the accountants have done what they were meant to achieve, and that the accounts are properly prepared in accordance with the relevant standards, whether it's general the US GAAP, UK GAAP, or international financial reporting standards. In terms of the different types of structures then, we have the euro bonds, we can have plain vanillas, typical basic euro bond issue, or we can have a whole series of variations, and we'll look at some of these. What we then had was this: we go from the long fixed bonds from the 1960s into the beginning of the 1970s because of the new foreign exchange and interest rate instability created by the collapse of the Bretton Woods system after Richard Nixon announced the closure of the gold window on 15th August 1971. With the closure of the gold exchange standard under the Bretton Woods system, we had massive new levels of foreign currency risk and interest rate risk. Because of that, what did the banks do? They developed a whole series of new instruments to help their customers manage these new risks. So on the one side, the whole of the beginning of the financial derivatives markets, futures, swaps and options, and then on the other side, we have the floating rate note market. So floating rate notes, because we're no longer going to have fixed interest rates because of the new interest rate volatility, banks don't want to lend fixed, they only want to lend floating, and we're going to calculate that with regards to the local interbank offered rate, the IBOR, in particular the London IBOR, the London interbank offered rate. In practice now, we tend to talk about risk-free rates, risk-free RFRs, Sonia, SOFR in New York, ESTR in Europe. So we have floating rate notes, and then as the instruments become shorter, we're going to set these up under note issuance facilities, NIFs. So we have FRNs, and then we have NIFs. The NIF is the disintermediation I mentioned before. We don't want to keep going back to the arranging bank. The issuing company or government just wants to issue once a month or once a year or whatever. It doesn't want to pay all the fees of having to re-engage the investment bank, so we set it up under a program, so we have a note issuance facility. The market dropped from the long bonds down to the short notes, and then it went back up again to the medium term notes, the MTNs. This basically comes from the American domestic MTN market. And then we have the short notes, the euro notes. Depending upon which book you're reading or which website you're looking at, you can get notes, euro notes, less than 1 year, which then overlaps with commercial paper. Technically, if it's less than 1 year, it's paper, but you can get very short notes. The difference, as I've said before, is that we look at the underwriting, we look at the issuance, we look at the maturities, we look at the settlement, and we look at the denomination. Basically, if they're sort of underwritten, large value, committed notes, they're not paper. We also have, we can have perpetuals. Governments can issue perpetuals, which means a bond that lasts forever. It can be redeemed if there's a major disruption. It's not that common. It's interesting that at the present time, with the current volatility in the markets, some advisors are suggesting that certain governments, such as the United Kingdom, should consider issuing perpetual bonds, very, very long bonds, or perpetual bonds, as a mark of confidence. Long bonds, 50-year bonds, tend to be restricted to, there's not a legal requirement, it just tends to be as a matter of practice, large international financial institutions. So the World Bank and the IMF, they may issue long 50-year bonds. Typically, bonds will be 20, 25 years. You have warrants. A warrant is something which is attached either to a bond or an equity, a share, which allows you to buy more of the same thing at a certain time at a certain price. A warrant is attached to allow you to buy more of the same thing. And then we can have convertibles. We can have bonds that are convertible into equity, or equity that's convertible into bonds. The most common form of this is now what we call COCOs, continuing convertible bonds, which we use for capital adequacy purposes. Following the global financial crisis, we very substantially increased the minimum capital requirements that the largest banks are required to hold. So if you're issuing a 100 million loan, technically, under the earlier Basel Committee on Banking Supervision standards, you have to hold 8% capital against that. 80 million. So you have to hold 8% capital against that loan. and that has to be shown in your accounted for in your books in some way. The requirements have now increased. That's gone up from core equity tier 1 was 2%. That was a quarter of the 8. That's now gone up to 4.5. And then we have three buffers, so 4.5 up to 7, up to 9.5, up to 12. And I'll give you materials on this separately if you're interested. All large institutions, if they're lending in the loan markets or if they're investing, participating in the capital markets, they have to hold capital against their risk, both for loan transactions and for capital market transactions. So we'll come back and look at that. So one of the most commonly used sets of convertibles now are these CoCos. So banks don't like shares. Companies don't like shares. Companies don't like shareholders. Nobody likes shareholders. Because shareholders have meetings and you have to provide lots of information to them and they can vote against all of the positions that the directors and senior managers want. They can restrict your golden hello when you arrive and your golden goodbye when you leave and your pension payments during the course of their term. Companies do not like shareholders. How do companies raise funds? They raise funds in the bond market. Everybody likes bondholders. Shareholders have to be paid dividends and have substantial controls, in particular through information, meetings and voting. Bondholders are paid interest, not dividends. They have some information, requirements, conditions, but they have much, much less control. Companies and banks specifically like bondholders. Nobody likes shareholders. So we have a situation whereby most companies, and in particular financial institutions, on their balance sheet, they will have much larger issuances of bonds than they will of shares. They'll only issue minimum amounts of shares which are technically required for whatever their company, corporate or other business planning purposes are. If they want to raise funds, they do it through the bond markets. A common way of making banks more stable now is to have CoCos, these convertibles, so they issue the bonds, but in the event that the bank gets into difficulty, the regulatory authorities can convert the bonds into equity and then write the equity off to cover any losses which are not otherwise dealt with on the balance sheet. We can also have equity linked, that's just tying the payments to other types of instruments. And then, as we've said already, the short instruments, less than 1 year, are commercial paper. We can have sterling commercial paper or euro commercial paper. And then we also, in this market, we have certificates of deposit, a CD. This then overlaps with the money market funds that we've talked about before. A CD is where we take a large deposit, let's say 10 million, we place it with a bank. What the bank can do is issue a receipt. That receipt effectively is a money market instrument. It's equivalent to a security, but technically it's a promissory note. And I'll come back and I'll summarise the difference between and the legal nature of these different types of instruments. We also have what we call a MOFE or a MOFE. A MOF, M-O-F, or a MOFE, M-O-F-F. Multi-option funding or a multi-option funding facility. That will include a number of other instruments which gives companies maximum flexibility. So, for example, just below, it may include a short-term multi-advance, a medium-term note programme, usually that's how they would raise funds, as well as European and domestic commercial paper, bankers' acceptances and a swing line facility. Bankers' acceptances means that the company can issue bonds and the banks will stamp them and accept them, which means they can be immediately discounted. You discount something by calculating the interest left until payment, and you deduct that from the face value. That's the discount. So if a bill is worth $100,000, if interest is a 3-month bill, if interest is 5,000 for the 3 months, you deduct the 5,000 off the 100,000, so you pay the face value less the 5,000, because then when you present the bill in 1 month, you get the full face value. So you basically roll the interest up as a discount. We call that bankers' acceptances. So that's the MOF, the multi-option facility. So we can use all these different types of instruments in all of these different types of ways. Let me just highlight one core point, first of all, which is at the bottom here. So I restate these ideas of immobilization, disintermediation. We've also got what we call demutualization and consolidation. Demutualization is another connected term. This is also on the front page as well. Demutualization and consolidation. Just so that we're clear, demutualization is to do with the status of the stock exchange on which you're buying and selling your bonds. What happens is over time is that the stock markets, the stock exchanges, such as the London Stock Exchange or the Luxembourg Stock Exchange or the New York Stock Exchange, they will change status. Historically, these were private associations, basically gentlemen's clubs. They were then not even companies, but associations. They could then become a private limited company or a public limited company, and what could then happen is they could demutualize, so they were no longer private members associations but public companies, and then they could buy and sell their own shares on their own markets. We call this demutualization. It's when the stock exchange moves from being an earlier private historical private club, and we'll come back and look at this, stock markets and exchanges, I'll give you a chapter on this separately. They historically demutualize. They go from being private members, associations, private members, clubs, to legal companies, and then they sell the shares to the general public, as well as they can sell their shares, trade their shares on their own markets. Because they're doing that, this happened with the London Stock Exchange. The London Stock Exchange used to be the listing authority. Listing means that if you're going to make an issue, whether it's bonds or shares to the general public, you have to comply with certain legal requirements with regards to listing. The London Stock Exchange was the listing authority, but because it demutualized and was basically selling its own shares on itself, we had to transfer responsibility for listing from the London Stock Exchange to the Financial Services Authority and then the Financial Conduct Authority. And we'll come back and we'll talk about big bangs. There was a big bang in London, 1985, 1986, when the London Stock Exchange did this, it demutualized. It opened itself up so that foreign institutions could buy all the stock brokers and stock jobbers on the London Stock Exchange. They abolished fixed commissions and they otherwise deregulated the market. This was called the big bang. So there was a big bang in London, 1985, 1986, when the stock exchange deregulated itself. It allowed foreign ownership, it abandoned fixed commissions because that was how stock brokers and stock jobbers used to make all their money. Stock brokers act on an agency basis for clients, stock brokers make markets themselves. Most stock markets now operate on a broker-dealer basis, whereby the broker is doing both the market making and buying and selling on behalf of clients. So it's agency and principal dealing. That's a broker-dealer. In England, that used to be called stock broking and stock jobbing. Stock broking is when you act as an agent for clients. Stock jobbing was when you created a market. We now call it broker dealers because they do both. Dual capacity broker dealers. So we have demutualization and then also we have consolidation. Consolidation simply refers to the more recent trend again whereby all the large stock markets and exchanges are buying each other up. They're all merging and coming together, so we get these increasingly large, powerful stock market groups in America, in Europe, and elsewhere. So just in terms of key market changes, key market trends, immobilization, dematerialization, disintermediation, demutualization, and consolidation. I also wanted to mention this. You'll see this referred to in my chapter and in other papers. What actually are these instruments that we're creating? In law, what is a bond? What is a note? And what is a piece of commercial paper? We can describe them in different ways. So I decided what I would try and do is work out all the possible variations and try and pull them all together. Essentially what we have is this. These bonds, notes and paper, they are short-dated, bearer, unsecured, negotiable, deposited, listed or unlisted, committed or uncommitted, promissory notes. In law, that's what they are. And I basically think that all bonds, notes and paper are qualified fall within all of these conditions. I think this is quite useful to sort of pull them all together. Short dated, bearer unsecured, negotiable, listed or unlisted, committed or uncommitted, promissory notes. Promissory notes under the Bills of Exchange Act. They're not bills of exchange because they're not directions to pay. They're promises to pay. There's three types of negotiable instrument: the bill of exchange, the cheque, and the promissory note. The bill of exchange is a direction by one merchant to another. A cheque is a direction on a bank to pay, and a promissory note is a promise or an undertaking to pay. So all of these instruments that we've looked at above, technically, legally, in my opinion, are short-dated, bearer, unsecured, negotiable, listed or unlisted, committed or uncommitted, promissory notes. What is the difference then between a loan deal and a bond deal? All I've otherwise done, and we'll come back to this, is on the table I've mentioned other types of instruments, bottom left. So we'll get UK gilt, stocks and bonds, US Treasury Agency, municipal bonds. These are the domestics, including the government bonds. And then we get into the corporate bond market. So Eurobond market, domestic state government bond market, and then domestic corporate bond market. So those are the three markets. And I just described all of the different types of terms in there. In this, it's actually quite interesting, in this part of the chapter, I look at all the different types of specific bonds. All the German bonds, all the Japanese bonds, and I describe all the language and I build in all the terminology. It's actually very, very interesting. On the back, we'll come back and we'll look at this in further detail. What's the difference between loan and bond documentation? And then what does the bond, the note and the paper actually look like? I've summarised that here and there. In terms of the basic core division between a loan deal and a bond deal, we deal with that on this page. So what we've got is this. In a loan deal, we have the borrower, the borrowing company, we have the agent bank, and we have a group of syndicate lenders. For example, 100 million, 10 banks lending 10 million each. Where do the funds come from? Do the banks actually have to have that on deposit? Do they actually look to their deposit base? No. Where does the funds come from? They just go into the interbank markets, below the euro dollar interbank market. All that happens is when the borrower wants to draw down funds, it notifies the agent bank. Agent bank sends an email or telex to each of the syndicate lenders. We need this amount in this currency by this Friday. And then that bank goes into the interbank markets, and only then does it actually draw down to make those funds available. That's the basic loan structure. Core documents, mandate letter, information memorandum, loan agreement. In the bond deal, what we'll see is this. The borrower becomes the issuer, either a corporate issuer or state issuer. And what we're going to do is this. We're going to have public and private investors at the bottom, and we're going to issue the debt, this time in the form of a negotiable and transferable security. It's not a loan agreement, it's not a bilateral loan agreement between the borrower and the syndicate. It's the debt is evidenced, embedded in a security which is issued into the market and can be bought and sold as a security. Depending upon the size of the deal, we'll then have a selling group. If the selling group is, if it's a very, very large deal, the selling group will be supported by an underwriting group. The underwriters are going to buy up anything the selling group can't sell. So if we're talking in the billions, you'll have a selling group and an underwriting group. If it's a very large issue, we're going to appoint the trustee on behalf of the bondholders. There'll also be an agent bank, but this time the agent bank isn't the agent of the bondholders, it's the agent of the issuing company. If there's a trustee, we have a paying agent. If there's no trustee, we have a fiscal agent. There may be other custodians. In practice, it's usually Euroclear and Clearstream who will hold the bonds when they're issued. Because there's more parties, there's more documents, so it becomes more complex in practice. But these documents tend to be shorter and simpler because we're spreading all the terms and conditions over a wider set of papers. So between the issuer and the managing, between the issuer and the underwriters, there'll be an underwriting agreement, there'll be a selling group agreement, but the key provision is between the issuer and the arranging bank. That's what we call the subscription agreement. The Asian bank, the arranging bank or the arranging bank group, is going to undertake to purchase or take on all of the bonds and arrange for their sale into the market. That's what the subscription agreement's for. That's the key legal obligation. The arranging bank's going to take on all of these bonds and make sure they get sold into the market. If it's a relatively small deal, and if it's a relatively big arranging bank, it may just take onto its own books, and we'll look at the different structures. But if it's a very large deal, we will then appoint a selling group and an underwriting group. I've made the point here. If you get more than one manager, in this case, it's not several, it's actually joint and several. So that's very different from the loan deal that we talked about before. We highlighted that the syndicate bank members are all acting severally, independently, as principal. In the bond deal, if you've got a large managing group entering into the subscription agreement with the issuer, it's actually joint and several liability. So we'll have a trust deed, we'll have a paying agency agreement or a fiscal agency agreement, with the selling agreements, and then any other separate custodian agreements that may be required. In terms of a typical timeline, I've tried to build this, create this. So we take the initial mandate, which is the same as in the loan deal. We'll have a pre-launch, which is roughly a week, 7 days before the D-Day. The D-Day is the public announcement of the launch. They call it syndication, but it's really just appointing all the parties, bringing everybody in. It's not like a loan syndication. The signing will be 2 weeks later, D-Day plus 14, and then the closing will be D-Day plus 21. So everything can occur around a 4 week period. We need to take the initial mandate, letter of instruction, appoint the lead bank or the arranging bank. Pre-launch, mandate letter, carry out the beginning of the early due diligence, including no conflicts of interest, fee letters, have everything agreed, all of the early documentation entered into. We're then going to begin to draft the core documents, and then we're going to circulate those, collect comments, prepare them for the signing, and then on the closing, we're technically going to provide for the issuance in return for the check for the total amount of the bond issuing place, whether it's 100 million or a billion or 10 billion, whatever it is. This used to be very interesting and very enjoyable in practice, because we would actually visit different places. So for the pre-launch and the launch, you'd have breakfast meetings at the investment bank. So you'd get a telephone call in your office in your law firm. We're having a breakfast meeting. We're going to start a new issue for 100 million on this, this and this. Put the phone down. So next morning, you'd show up at one of the beautiful offices in Liverpool Street or in the City of London. You begin to negotiate the documentation, you put everything together, you circulate the documents, then you'll have a formal signing, and then you'll have a formal closing. And very often you'll book like a large room, like a conference centre, conference room, and the bigger the deal, the bigger the conference centre has to be, and this was very enjoyable. In practice now, a lot of it's all closed, it's all done electronically. So you'll sit in your room late at night and you'll be getting documents coming in from Bahrain, from Singapore, Shanghai. You'll be collecting all of this. You'll be putting everything together. It'll all be done electronically. So between day one and a month later, you're just sitting in your office. But it's still very enjoyable. It's exciting work. It's a high level, high quality stuff. Now, there's three main different forms. We can have a private placement, we can have a preliminary prospectus offering, or we can have an impact day offering. A private placement is whereby we're going to sell to a small select group. This can also be called a bought deal. So if it's a big arrangement bank, it's a big investment bank, it will already have a selling team within its building, within its office, and it will be able to basically place almost anything. So very often, in smaller and medium-sized deals, they'll just be bought deals. The arranging bank will say, we'll take on everything, we'll arrange the selling, we'll ensure that you receive the full amount that you're expecting. So that's a bought deal. A private placement legally is when you sell to a small limited group of public members, so it doesn't constitute the general public, therefore you don't trigger listing requirements and a lot of heavy securities law. Different countries have different numbers. Sometimes it's less than 100, sometimes it's less than 200. I'll give you notes, for example, on the American system and how you basically avoid having to comply with the Securities Act 1933, which provides for first issuance, and the Securities and Exchange Act 1934, which provides for second trading, including as well as the new, the no-fraud rules. I'll give you separate materials on this so you can become an American legal expert as well. I personally am a member of the New York Bar for that reason. A lot of people who work in this area, I was initially qualified in Edinburgh, Scotland, but we re-qualify in London, but we also do the New York Bar. Because for governing law purposes, almost all of these contracts, or the largest volume of contracts, will be governed by English law or New York law, and they will select New York or London for their jurisdiction. So we'll get the private placement. It's technically the legal term whereby we sell to a small select group of professional investors, therefore we do not trigger listing and we do not trigger a lot of the heavy securities law, which costs a lot of additional funds because it's a lot of extra time. The alternative is what we call a preliminary prospectus offering. We use what we call a red heading or a pathfinder. In the loan deal, we're going to have the information memorandum provides all the necessary information so that the syndicate members can understand the deal, price the deal, decide whether they want to participate and how much they want to contribute. In the bond deal, that becomes the prospectus. And if we're going to list on a stock market, that becomes the listing particular. And there's two types of listing, just so we get this right, or two types of admission. If we're going to be admitted, we get admitted to listing to sell to the general public, but we can also get admitted to trading on a specific stock exchange. So if we want to sell to the general public, we are admitted to listing in the UK or elsewhere. But also, if we want to sell on a specific stock market, we will get admitted to the London Stock Exchange or the Luxembourg Stock Exchange or Brussels Stock Exchange. Okay? So you get two types of admission. Listing is when we want to sell to the general public rather than go for a private placement. With a preliminary prospectus offering, we're going to prepare the prospectus. As I've explained, the prospectus is the equivalent to the information memorandum in the loan deal. It provides all the information about the issuer, the background, the business, its financial condition, what it's going to use the funds for, how it will redeem the funds later. All of that will be dealt with in the prospectus. With a preliminary offering prospectus, we prepare a red heading or a pathfinder prospectus. If we're going to list, the prospectus becomes the listing particulars. So the prospectus and the listing particulars are the same thing. If we're going to list. If we're not going to list, you just have the prospectus. So we're going to prepare a draft prospectus and we're going to show it to the market. We're going to get a response, opinion, reaction, to get some idea of price. Because what we're trying to do is this. We know how much we want to raise, so usually that's not negotiable. It may be. The company or the government will have to talk to the investment bank at the beginning to discuss how much it thinks it could raise and what it's going to cost. This is how it's all done. So we're going to confirm how much we can raise, but the key thing is, what's the price going to be? What's the coupon? The interest rate is the coupon. So we need to determine the price of the bond and the interest paid, which is the coupon. Now the price as well, we may either issue at par, is face value, or at discount, or at premium. If we think the market will take a premium, we'll sell at a premium, because we think they're going to go up in value immediately after. Or we can sell at a discount, and then lower the interest rate. We can also have what we call deep discount bonds, deep discount securities. And what that means is this, it's the same thing I mentioned before about acceptance houses and discounting bills. You calculate the interest, and you deduct that from the face value. So a deep discount bond may sell at 30% of its face value, but pay no interest. When you redeem, you get the 100 million. Now, why might you want to do that? For tax reasons. A lot of institutional investors, such as large pension companies, they don't want to pay corporate tax on their earnings each year. They don't need that. They want long-term investments, long-term instruments. So to avoid paying tax, they want a 10-year bond, or a 20-year bond, a deep discount. So they buy the deep discount at 70%,
on the face value. They keep it, and then it redeems at full value. So you lock up all the interest into the profit, which you redeem at the end. So that's called a deep discount bond. So we can either sell the bond at par, its face value, at discount, or a deep discount, or premium when we sell above. So what we need to do is this. We need to determine the price. We need to determine the coupon. And we will do that with the preliminary prospectus offering. That's the most commonly used format in the Eurobond deal, as well as in domestic American and domestic Canadian deals. Preliminary offering prospectus. In the UK, we can also have another form, which is a bit more risky, called an impact day offering. This is more like a big equity issue, like an IPO. What we're going to do is this. The investment bank is going to discuss with the clients what we think the market will take, and we're going to announce that on the offering date, and then that's fixed. It's a bit more risky because we may have changes in between, but it might be very profitable, and so long as the investment bank reads the market properly, it can be completely effective in practice. That's more common in a UK domestic. On other types of more standard deals, when it's just the Bank of England issuing treasury bills or gilts, we just use simple option rules and just much more simple procedures. But for the big issues, we can either use preliminary prospectus offerings or we can use impact day offerings. So that's the timeline as well. So D-Day minus 7, D-Day, D-Day plus 14, D-Day plus 21. We'll have the signing, we have the drafting between D-Day and 2 weeks later, D-Day for the signing. We'll have everything entered into, so all the legal commitments are undertaken. We'll then exchange all the final documents, comply with any other conditions precedent or other conditions. On the closing, technically we're going to transfer the funds in exchange for the bonds. But in practice, we don't see the bonds. Usually what will happen is there'll be a 40-day lockup or lockdown. This is for American legal purposes. We have what we call the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 1982, called the TEFRA. The Americans don't like the euro bond market. They specifically don't like the euro bond market because it's a bearer bill market and it allows American citizens to avoid paying their tax and to hide wealth. Americans like registered bonds. So one of the penalties is that under the TEFRA, and there's various conditions within TEFRA, the issuing bank through their arranging bank will have to notify to the American authorities that this bond has not been sold to any Americans anywhere. That can take up to 40 days. So we have a 40-day lockdown for American tax purposes and for confirmation purposes. But also in practice, this is actually very useful because it takes 40 days to actually print the bonds. It will take time for these to be produced. You cannot produce these within 1 week or within 2 weeks. So before these can get deposited, because they're going to be immobilized with Euroclear and Clearstream, we need to print them. So that will take 40 days anyway. So you will normally instruct the printers to prepare the bonds, but they're not going to even have to be released for 40 days. And by complete coincidence, we use the same 40 days as we need to notify under TEFRA for American tax law purposes. So you have a 40-day lockdown period, and what happens during that period, we have what we call the TBG, the Temporary Global Bond, and you'll see there, TGB. The TGB is the temporary global, which means we're going to have one bond representing everything. So this bond that I'm holding up is a European Investment Bank. It's the issue was $100,000, 7 5/8% bonds due 2006. This one is a 10,000 value bond, £10,000 bond. What will happen is the temporary global will be issued for the full amount, 100,000 or 100 million. This is a sui generis legal instrument. You issue a bond, only one page, one of these for 100 million or 100,000. That's called the temporary global. It's completely sui generis in law, and it only lives for 40 days. It only lasts for 40 days because that's what's exchanged on the closing. The issuer has to issue the bonds. So it issues a temporary global, a TGB, in exchange for
the subscription price, 100 million, or the billion, or the whatever else. After 40 days, that TGB is replaced by all the definitive bonds, which will come in a van, because there will be boxes and boxes of these certificates, depending upon the size and the total amount that's issued. In practice, these will be delivered directly to the custodians, Euroclear or Clearstream, although now a lot of it will be dematerialised, so it's issued in an electronic form only, but we'll still have to have the 40-day lockdown. And that is a typical Eurobond and bond and commercial paper market deal. So we've got the timeline, we've got the structure, and we've got all of the key terms and provisions, and with that we can understand everything to do with the basic structure and operation of this very important, very exciting market.